Metcast, Thursday, October 30th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Maccast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. Well, it's been a little while since I last spoke to you. If you follow me on Twitter, you probably know why we've had a little longer delay between episodes. For those of you who didn't see that, I had a little bit of a family thing going on, an emergency. We're all okay. Everything's fine. And I appreciate all the support and nice comments on Twitter. But it did just delay this episode of the show a little bit. I've been taking notes and working on things, but just had to address some other personal issues. And that, you know, happens every once in a while. Life kind of inserts itself in different ways. And you have to kind of take a break sometime and deal with things. So that's all that was going on. It actually does bring up kind of a topic that I've brought up on the show from time to time, and we probably haven't talked about it in a while, but every time I ask, the response I get is, don't worry, we understand you're going to be here and a new show will be coming, even if something happens in your life that you need to attend to. But would you want to know or be somehow notified? I've often thought about putting something in the feed to let you know. Or are you okay just sort of waiting? And the response I usually get is, hey, we're okay. We can wait for a new episode. But I want to make sure we're still in that place. If you feel differently, that's fine. You know, I can even, barring a huge emergency, I can always drop something in the feed and just maybe give you a little update. Otherwise, if you do want to know about that stuff, probably the best thing to do is just follow me on Twitter or keep in touch on the Facebook page, or Twitter's probably the best because that's where I do most of my updating. Just in case you're wondering, hey, where's that show, Adam? What have you been doing? Where did you go? You can find out that information usually there. But consequently, we have lots of interesting things to talk about in this episode. Apple had their quarterly results call, so there's some big new numbers there. We're getting benchmarks and information on the new Macs that Apple announced at the last event. Also, iOS 8.1 we really haven't talked about, and a bunch of stuff blowing up with Apple Pay in different capacities. And then the teardown of the iPad Air 2 has some interesting results. And of course, a whole thing going on with the GT Advanced on the whole Sapphire thing. So we've got all those stories to get into, a bunch of your tips and tricks and feedback and things like that, as we always do. I'm looking forward to getting into all of that. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile Software. And, you know, they've been sponsoring the show and been a big supporter of the show for a long, long time. What's interesting is I've been a Smile customer for even longer than that, long before they started sponsoring this podcast. I think I had just about every app that they make, and I still do to this day because it's great stuff. They make really great software. You know, their name comes from the fact that when you use their products, they want you to smile. They want you to have a great experience. So they have PDF Pen Scan Plus out now. That is a great app if you're going paperless, because often the best time to scan a document is right when you receive it. I've had this problem with, you know, I have a scan snap, but getting that data in is kind of that most critical moment. And if you start having things pile up, it becomes a chore. So with PDF Pen Scan Plus, you can literally take your iOS device, the device that you have with you, you can snap a photo, and it will give you all the tools and controls to adjust the contrast, to do it in black and white or grayscale or color, however you want to import it, and get it into a PDF format that you can use. You can even scan multiple pages effortlessly, if I can speak today. And you can do things like, you know, scan receipts or even custom paper sizes. It doesn't really matter. And it does OCR as well, which means that you will be able to get the text, you'll be able to search through it, and you can easily get that into other documents. And with their latest version, they've improved OCR accuracy, they've improved the layout, they also now have auto export features to go right into Dropbox or even PDF Pen's iCloud storage, so you can share with PDF Pen for iOS and Mac. So it really is part of a larger workflow. I typically scan things in and then we'll bring them into PDF Pen to continue to work with them either on my iOS device or on my Mac. And that's another great thing about all the Smiles applications is they integrate and work together seamlessly. Also, we have Text Expander now, especially Text Expander Touch has the new keyboard, so you can use your Text Expander snippets in any app on iOS 8. So just really great apps. And if you haven't tried a Smile application, or maybe you have one of them and you haven't tried some of the others, you should really head over to their website, smilesoftware.com. And you can get free trials of their Mac applications. You can check out all of their iOS applications, get more information and details. And I'm just so happy that they continue to be a sponsor of the MacCast. So please support them because they support us. And check them out, smilesoftware.com. And a big thanks for their support of the MacCast. So let's just jump right into things. Apple rocked their latest quarterly results call. For the fiscal year ending 2014, Q4, they raked in $8.5 billion in net profit, and that was on revenues of $42.12 billion. They had record iPhone sales in the quarter, 39.27 million units. That was up from 37.79 million units a year ago, so that really helped push those numbers up. Some of those were iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, but you remember those devices weren't available or were only available for the last few weeks of the quarter. So I found that number to be even a little more impressive because that means iPhone sales continue to be very, very strong. iPad sales were not quite as good. They continued to slow a little bit. They sold 12.3 million units. That was down from about 13.1 million units a year ago. And they did just have the iPad Air 2 update. So we'll have to see if that sort of helps iPad numbers in the first quarter. Tim Cook, I think, was a little bit positive on that. But, you know, even saying that some of this quarter numbers might have been folks holding off to see what Apple was going to do with the updates. I'm not so sure, though. I don't know that the iPad is one of those things where we're going to constantly see huge numbers every time a new device comes out. And I think part of that is Apple being a victim of its own success. You know, iPads are becoming the PC or Mac replacements that Tim Cook predicted years ago when they announced the iPad. And along with that, I think they're bringing more PC-like upgrade cycles for folks. So you get an iPad, it works very well. It doesn't crash. It doesn't have issues. It does what you need it to do. It's a nice, reliable device. And when a new one comes out, you don't necessarily feel that you really need to upgrade. So you're going to hold off for another couple years before you actually go out and buy a new one. So I think we're going to kind of continue to see sort of steady sales. I don't think they're going to slow dramatically. I mean, even in this quarter, it was a small drop from a year ago. And I think we'll kind of continue to see it sort of balance out like that. And, you know, where Apple's going to show the big numbers is when they launch a whole new product category, something like the Apple Watch. And iPhones continue to be hugely successful, but that's because, you know, geeks upgrade, and those have sort of a built-in with contracts, although even that might be going away, this sort of built-in two-year upgrade cycle. What was really surprising in these quarterly results, though, I thought, were the stats on Mac sales. Apple sold more than 5.5 million Macs in the quarter. That is a new quarterly record, and that's really good news because this is still in a period where PC sales continue to sort of be on the decline. And I think another reason for that is folks moving to tablets, things like the iPad, and maybe not upgrading their desktops that frequently. But Apple continued to show very strong sales in the Mac market. That, of course, is led by their notebook lineup, which did see some recent revisions. I think also back to school always helps that sort of thing. So a lot of folks picking up new Macs as they head back to classes. And the numbers certainly showed it. I think there's also that whole halo effect that happens with people getting iPhones and iPads and wanting to move further into the Apple ecosystem. So good numbers on the Mac side. And not surprisingly, iPod sales, well, those continue to slide. And I think we'll continue to see that as more people move into all-in-one devices, you know, having your music on your iPhone or your iPad. You don't necessarily need that iPod anymore. I don't think iPods are going away. I think they're, again, just one of those products that's in Apple's lineup that has really matured to a level where it serves a certain segment and will continue to serve that segment. You know, if you want to work out and you want to just have your music with you, a Shuffle or a Nano is going to be a great device for that. Maybe you don't want to carry that big bulky phone, especially now that we have larger phones. The iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, you know, are maybe a little bit less appealing in that sort of scenario. So I think folks are going to continue to have iPods. It's just that we're not going to see those huge numbers we saw, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, things like that. That's just, those days are gone for the iPod. And I think we saw that also with the discontinuation of the iPod Classic. Although recently, Tim Cook did comment on that and said, really, the reason they got rid of that is they literally couldn't find parts for it anymore. They could not source the parts that they needed to continue to build that device. Just the manufacturers weren't making the bits and parts. And I guess they could have redesigned it and maybe updated it. Some folks would have liked to have seen them do that, but you know, it probably doesn't sell enough units to really warrant a redesign. Thus, they just chose to discontinue it. So, some other interesting things came out of the quarterly results call. One of the most interesting things, I think, was that Apple is going to create a whole new category for reporting their financial results. A category they're calling Other, which is going to combine the sales of the iPod, the Apple TV, any Beats products and other accessories that Apple's going to sell. And this is the interesting part, the Apple Watch. It's all going to be lumped into this big Other category. So when the Apple Watch launches early 2015, it's going to be really hard to sort of break out the exact number of watch sales and kind of get a picture of maybe what the watch sales look like. And I say exact picture, you're going to know pretty well when the Apple Watch launches and that other number comes into play. When it's a huge, huge amount, that big uptake is, you know, that difference between the quarter before and the Apple Watch quarter, it's going to be pretty easy to draw some kinds of conclusions about how Apple Watch did in terms of its sales numbers and its profitability. But you're just not going to get that exact number that maybe analysts and folks would really hope to get for that. So I don't know exactly strategically, because I'm not a business guy, why Apple wants to do that, sort of hide the Apple Watch in those numbers. But looks like that's what they're planning to do. And we're just going to have to wait until that results call happens sometime in early 2015. But overall, Apple just really blowing out the fourth quarter of the year and doing really, really well. And I always like to see that, because, you know, it's what's good for Apple is sort of good for us Apple fans, right? So Apple did announce a couple new Macs at their last event, where they announced the new iPads as well, the iPad Air 2 and the iPad Mini. But what sort of stole the show was that new 5K iMac. And iFixit did an autopsy on Apple's newest offering and found some interesting things. One was that internally, it was mostly unchanged. I think it's no surprise that the major exception to that is the panel, the glass, the display that's on it, that 27-inch 5120 by 2880 pixel 5K Retina display. In their teardown, the one that they had was made by LG. I don't know if that means that all of the 5K panels are coming from LG. Apple's been often known to use multiple suppliers for their displays, but LG certainly factoring into it. The iMac also has that new Apple-designed custom LCD timing controller, so they were able to kind of find that. There was actually a whole strip sort of board embedded in the panel that has all the different chips and controllers and things like that on it. And the data cable running between the logic board and the display is wider on the Retina iMac compared to the prior generation. And that's likely to support all the additional bandwidth and components that are built into that new display. Other than that, the rest of the layout, they say the internal components remained largely unchanged. Of course, the processors and GPUs, those did get a nice bump with this latest version. Their next generation Intel Core i5 and i7 Haswell processors, and you've also got those AMD Radeon 290X and 295X, graphics units in there. And with that new horsepower and new graphics under the hood, you might be wondering, well, how is the new iMac doing in performance tests? And it's actually doing surprisingly well. It beats the late 2013 iMac models with Core i7 3.5 gigahertz processor by 13.3% in single core benchmarks and 11.1% in multi-core benchmarks. That's pitting the, you know, the top of the line 2013 iMac against the very fastest 5K Retina iMac configuration. That's the one using a 4.0 gigahertz quad-core Haswell i7 chip. If you want to know the actual numbers, the Geekbench scores came in for single-core performance at 4,438 and multi-core came in at 16,407. So it is a nice little bump from the prior generation iMac. What's really interesting, though, is both new Retina iMac configurations, the 3.5 gigahertz i5 and the 4.0 gigahertz i7, managed to beat even the latest Mac Pro in single-core performance tests. So the 4.0 gigahertz iMac beat the Mac Pro by 23.2%, and the 3.5 gigahertz version was able to best the Mac Pro by 7.8%. Now, again, that's in single-core tests. In multi-core tests, the Mac Pro, though, cannot be touched. The highest-end Mac Pro bested the highest-end Retina iMac by 98.4% in multi-core tests. So it's really going to depend on the kind of work that you're doing. I think I talked a little bit on the last MacCast when we talked about the announcements that it really seemed like Apple was positioning the iMac as a unit for pro-level consumers or very high-end consumers. Making that sort of, this is the thing, if you want a 5K display, if you want an Apple 4K display, because they didn't announce a 4K Thunderbolt display or anything like that of their own, they seem to be saying, okay, this is for pros, and they even had pro photographer up there in some of the videos kind of showing off all the stuff you could do with a Mac Pro. But if you need multi-core performance, and that is critical for your workflow, the Mac Pro still is the top of the heap. So the iMac does very, very well and does fine in multi-core. I don't want to give the impression that it doesn't have good multi-core scores. It just can't match the Mac Pro when it comes to that. But still, nice little bump up in terms of performance using those newer Haswell processors. I'm sure Apple would have loved to have used the next generation Broadwell stuff from Intel, but obviously they didn't come into market this year and they're just not available. So Apple's having to stick with the Haswell, and they did a nice job with the bump in the iMac. Of course, Apple also revved the Mac Mini and it received some benchmark testing. A lot of folks not necessarily as happy with the upgrades Apple has made to the Mac Minis, specifically in terms of the processors. So many folks are wondering, you know, how is it going to perform in terms of the benchmarks? And we saw those numbers, and it showed improved single-core performance over the last revision, which was in 2012. So it's, you know, been almost 2 years, but unfortunately showed decreased multi-core performance in benchmark scores. So in single core tests, there was about a 2 to 8% speed increase over the 2012 models. But when you got into dual core testing, the dual core 2012 models versus the 2014, the benchmark showed performance actually down 7%. And then because Apple's not offering a quad core version of the 2014 Mac Mini, when you took dual core performance of the 2014 versus the quad core 2012s, well, that was, again, no contest. Performance was down 70 to 80% because you've lost, you know, two whole cores. And so, you know, many folks are kind of saying, hey, the Mac minis now are underpowered. Apple took away the server options, so you can't get the whole dual drive thing. And a lot of folks, especially, again, more on the pro side and the IT side, rely on the Mac mini for all kinds of different things. So there's been lots of speculation as to why the Mac mini only has dual cores. And one of those that seems likely is that the Haswell dual core and quad core processors actually use different sockets. Now, this is a change from the prior generation Ivy Bridge processors, where those actually use the same socket design for dual and quad cores. So if Apple wanted to continue offering both dual core and quad core on the mini, it would mean they'd have to have different logic board designs for the different, or different logic board requirement for the different versions to support the quad core and the dual core. And because of, you know, probably the number of units Apple sells in terms of the Mac mini, they likely made the decision that they didn't want to have to sort of run two logic board designs. So that may be why we're only seeing dual core models in the Mac mini. But that still, you know, leaves the fact that a lot of folks really felt a little bit let down by this upgrade. And you can certainly see that when you're looking at the benchmark numbers. I think you can understand that. And I've been getting some comments from a few of you, including this bit of feedback that I received from Marco.
Hey, Adam, this is Marco, longtime listener from Germany. I wanted to share my thoughts on the new Mac minis that Apple has just announced. You have talked about them in your last show, and I wanted to share my thoughts about it, as I'm a photographer, and the Mac mini has always been the Mac of choice for many of us, as we get to choose our own display when we buy a Mac mini. And Apple has had somewhat of a bad track record with displays. I mean, screen retention has been an issue for many, but also the problem is that Apple doesn't only have one supplier for the displays. So in the past, a lot of us have been playing display lottery with you don't know what you're gonna get. Some displays usually were better than others, and we were always trying to get the better ones, but there was really no telling. Even when you went to the store, you had to buy it, unpack it, check if you got the good or the bad screen, and then return it. And this is certainly nothing you want to do when you pay so much money for a product, and I'm sure this is also no fun for Apple. So I don't know why the specs or the standards, the minimum standards, have been rather low for a company that has really grown with graphic designers and visual artists in the past. Anyway, so I have been desperately waiting for the new Mac Mini, as I needed a little bit more powerful Mac to keep up with the bigger demands of the newer cameras, raw pixel sizes, and the previous Mac Mini I skipped because the graphic card, the 4000 HD, was a bit too weak for what I wanted to have in my next update. So I've been waiting for quite some time, for over a year and a half, for this new Mac Mini to be announced, and now it was announced, and the entry level is a nice slow processor, but a nice entry-level Mac at a lower price. It's really appreciated, I think, for a lot of people who want to start with a first Mac, or who just need a small Mac, maybe as home entertainment server for home use. But for some people who want to use the Mac Mini professionally, that Apple has dropped the quad-core option is really a killer for this decision. And I know a lot of other photographers I've talked to said, okay, Mac Mini is out, what do we do now? There really isn't a good alternative, because you don't want to buy a quad-core MacBook Pro where you don't really need the screen when you want to attach it to your own high-quality graphic display. And buying a Mac Pro is too expensive and way overpowered for what I need. I don't do video editing, So I just need raw quad-core power to process my photos in Lightroom. And Lightroom is a very core-intensive application. So basically, we're stuck here. We really don't know what to do. I could run Lightroom on a Windows, but I've been in the Mac and Apple camp for so long, I really can't see myself jumping that route. Apple did announce the 5K iMac, and that might be an option. I have to look at the display if that could work out for me, and I guess if you compare to a current 27-inch i7 iMac with the same processor powers, the 5K, the basic, the 3.5 gigahertz i7, and maybe compare it or upgrade the regular to a 256 internal SSD as a system drive, then the prices are almost the same. I think the 5K iMac only runs 100 euro and probably in the US US dollar more. So that's certainly an option, but we'll have to go to the store and take a look at the displays, if it's really that good, if the graphic cards can really handle crunching all those pixels at a decent frame rate. And in the end, I guess Apple will be successful in us having to spend a lot more money on an iMac than just upgrading to a top-of-the-line Mac Mini. I'm also wondering what all the server farms will do who have that have bought Mac Minis in the past and used them as servers. So I don't know what they will do if the discontinuation of the quad-core has an impact on that market too. And as far as I know, there's also no new Mac Mini server. So I hope that Apple will kind of redo the step and offer some more powerful Mac Minis in the future again. That's really my wish, because I think there was certainly a market for it. And it's okay if they even up the price a bit, but for many of us, we just enjoy choosing our own displays, and Apple has not been producing the best and most reliable quality display. So that's just what I wanted to share with you and your listeners. Keep up the good work. Always looking forward to when your podcast pops up in my iTunes list, and can't wait to listen to it while I mostly sit here and edit photos. Take care.
Hey, thanks, Marco. You know, I really appreciate the feedback, and I think your sort of sentiments on the issue are shared by a lot of folks, I think, both in the sort of pro level side of things, but even just from, you know, the consumer side of things, I think I agree with you in terms of the base model, right? It's nice that they dropped the price $100, that we're back at that $499 price point, but you start looking at the specs and you just realize how really underpowered that unit feels. It's a 1.4 gigahertz dual core processor with an Intel HD 5000 graphics and just 4 gigs of RAM. And it's been discovered now that the RAM in the new Mac Mini design is no longer user replaceable. It is soldered in. So you're really going to be stuck at that 4 gigabytes of RAM if you buy that model. So I would have a hard time recommending anyone other than maybe, I find it hard even to sell to someone who's saying, hey, you're switching over from a PC and you want to save money, get the $499 Mac Mini, because I just have a feeling that they're going to be disappointed and they're going to be wanting to upgrade within a year. And maybe that's what Apple's hoping, is that you'll buy that and then a year later jump up to an iMac or something like that. I don't really know. The good news is it does seem like the hard drives are still upgradable. But, you know, I really think if you're getting into a Mac Mini, that sweet spot is going to be the 2.6 gigahertz, you know, the 699 model, not the 599. So spend $200 more. You're going to get way more processor in the dual core Intel i5. You're going to get double the RAM, double the hard drive, and the update to the Intel Iris graphics. So I don't know why, you know, Apple even has the 1.4 gigahertz, the bottom of the line. We know why they have the bottom of the line one, right? It's to get the price point under 500. But I think that was the wrong way to go about it. And then, like you said, the server configuration's going away. That's going to be a big deal for server farms and more of the IT side of things, especially since Apple had discontinued, you know, the Xserves. A lot of folks had moved on to the Mac Mini because the size makes them perfect for mounting in a rack. I guess you could say, well, you know, you can rack mount and side mount the Mac Pros, but that gets really, really expensive very, very quickly. So if you just need to build a big array of servers or something like that, the Mac Mini was really ideal. And I don't know that in its current configuration, it's really as appealing as it was before. So Apple did make some interesting decisions. On the processor side, I think when the new Broadwell chips come out, I think we will see a rev of the Mac Mini again. I'm hoping it comes a lot sooner than 2 years. And again, I'm with you. I hope Apple kind of reconsiders and gives a little more love and a little more power to the Mac Mini, because I think it serves a small but important segment of the Mac market. So it'll be interesting to watch and see what they do. But maybe this is also the sign that the Mac Mini is at its end of days. I would really hope not. But maybe it's going to slowly just, you know, see the sales slow down and drop to the point where Apple just considers it not part of the lineup anymore. I really hope that day doesn't come or happen. But I could also see that becoming a reality. But love to know what you all think. If you have a comment on the Mac Mini or the new iMac, especially if you've picked up either one of these models, we'd love to get some firsthand feedback and some responses. Let us know what you think. You know, maybe we're thinking about this too much from the spec side of things and not the real world side of things. If you've picked up a new Mac Mini and you really love it, let us know what you like about it and what you think. So send us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. So iOS 8 had a little bit of a rough start with iOS 8.0.1, and then we quickly got the 8.2 update that kind of fixed things and made things a little bit better, but it was still pretty rough around the edges. Finally, we got iOS 8.1, and we thought, all right, this is going to solve all of our problems, but it turns out, no, it's still a little bit rough around the edges, a little bit less rough, so not so grating, but the update did bring bug fixes and also some new killer features, including Apple Pay support for the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. That's US only, but actually does seem to work abroad with NFC readers as long as you have a US credit card and you're using that. But it does seem to work in other countries. It's just you won't be able to use it if you live in another country and don't have a US credit card. We also, in the update, got the iCloud Photo Library beta. And the camera roll and my photo stream albums returned, and you will only see those if you have not enabled the iCloud Photo Library. So if you haven't enabled iCloud Photo Library, camera roll and my photo stream albums are back in the Photos app. I've commented on this on a couple of shows. You know, they kind of misled us saying, oh, the camera roll is returning. And I was thinking, the camera roll in the camera app, right? You take your pictures and you're in the camera app. You tap on the little, you know, photo, the last photo you took, the little icon, thumbnail in the lower left-hand corner, and it brings up the camera roll inside the camera app. It doesn't work that way. It's more like they just sort of relabeled the areas in the Photos app, or actually added an additional photo album called Camera Roll into the Photos application. So now when you tap that little preview image, you can see the last image that you took inside the camera roll. But then if you want to see your other images, you have to tap the Show All Photos link, and that will open and launch the photo application. And it doesn't even, this is what really bugs me, it doesn't even take you back to the camera roll, you know, directly from the camera app. What it does is it drops you in whatever album or whatever location you had last open in the Photos app. So you actually have to tap on the albums and then tap on camera roll, and then you can see all your images. So not quite exactly the old camera roll back, but at least you have a thing called camera roll, and semantically, I guess it makes it a little bit easier to find. The other thing that iOS 8 brought is the ability for iPhone users to send and receive SMS and MMS messages from their iPads and Macs. So that's one of the handoff continuity sorts of features. And did seem to have some fixes for Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, resolve some issues for one. I'm still kind of having flaky Bluetooth audio, particularly with my JBL Flip 2 speakers. And I'm finding I'm having to sort of reset the Bluetooth connection more frequently than I'd like. So I don't know that Apple got all of those network connectivity issues worked out. But let's talk about a few of the features, the new features, in case you haven't checked them out, because some of them require a little bit of configuration to actually use, specifically things like the SMS and MMS feature. It needs to be enabled if you're running OS X Yosemite. So this is a feature that integrates with Yosemite. It'll let you take send and receive SMS and MMS messages from your Mac. But you need to click on the Apple menu and you need to go into the System Preferences, and then you need to click on General, and you need to make sure the option for Allow Handoff is checked on. And then once you've done that, you're also going to need to make sure that you activate the text message forwarding on your iOS devices. So first thing you do is you need to make sure that you're signed into iMessage on your Mac, and that you're also signed in to iMessage on your iOS devices. And then on your iOS device, you'll go into Settings, and then you need to tap on the Messages settings, and then link your Mac, you know, link it to the Mac using text messaging forwarding to actually enable the feature. And when you do that, then you have to actually, you'll get a little code that's displayed on your iOS device, and you need to enter that code in your Mac to verify, yes, I want to set up this connection between the two devices. And then once you've done that, you'll be able to do your messaging SMS back and forth from your Mac through your iPhone or your iOS device. Another thing, as I mentioned before, that iOS 8.1 brought was Apple Pay. And we're going to talk a lot more about Apple Pay here in a second. But if you want to be able to use Apple Pay, you do need to set it up. And that process isn't necessarily obvious. You need to open up Settings or Passbook to actually be able to see the Apple Pay features. So if you open up Passbook, you press the little plus icon in Passbook, and that's going to allow you to add a card to be used for Apple Pay. If you already have a card on file for iTunes, you can actually tap a little link that'll be displayed and automatically add that card to Passbook. If you're adding a card manually, you can actually do it with the camera on your iOS device. So you just hold the credit card you want to add to Apple Pay up to the camera, and it'll actually scan it. It'll find the number in many cases, although in my experience, not always. It'll find the expiration date, and then you'll just need to manually enter the little security code from your card to actually get the card added. And some cards, I haven't had any that do this, but some cards do require some additional verification steps. So it'll have to maybe check things with your bank. It might have to actually call you, you know, place a phone call or double check an email, send you an email, those sorts of things. So some cards have those additional steps. And just remember, you know, not all banks and not all cards are supported. So I actually found, in my case, my Chase Business Visa card, or MasterCard rather, was not supported. And I guess any Chase MasterCards are not supported. And I wasn't able to actually add those to Passbook. But it simply just told me that when I tried to add that card. And then with Apple Pay, there are some additional card options that you can check out by going into Settings on your iOS device and accessing the Passbook and Apple Pay settings. In there, you can set up transaction defaults like the billing address and the shipping address to be used when you're using an Apple Pay. So that'll be real handy if you're using Apple Pay in an app or online, so you don't have to fill out that information. It'll automatically use whatever defaults that you've set in the settings for Passbook and Apple Pay. You can also plug in email and phone numbers. Some cards will actually, and this is really handy, display your recent transactions. So you can actually go in and look at your transaction history. My American Express card enabled me to do that. And I like that feature a lot. Unfortunately, my Chase card, my debit card, doesn't provide that functionality. So I don't know if that's something developers can just simply enable, or if it's tied to, you know, particular banks or cards. But having that in there, you can access it from that settings screen. And then also from that screen, when you're looking at your cards, you can see the partial device account number. That's the unique account number that's generated so that Apple is not actually storing any of your credit card data or information on your device, and they're just generating that little code number. So that was interesting to see there. And that's the thing that's used to sort of generate the payment tokens that will be sent for each transaction that you do with Apple Pay. But Apple Pay, in experience, I've used it a few times now. It is really as easy to use at supported terminals as they showed in their little demo video. All you have to do if you want to use Apple Pay is just look for any card readers or scanners, so where you swipe your card. They have that little sort of bump on the top, and it has what Michael Johnston of the iOS show is calling the little Wi-Fi egg. It looks like an egg-shaped circle with some Wi-Fi lines in it, and that is sort of the NFC symbol. Also, some terminals, I guess, although I haven't seen these, actually will have a little Apple Pay logo on them. But if you see that, you can just simply either rest your finger on the Touch ID sensor and tap your device to it, or just hold your device near the reader. And once, you know, they've rung in your transaction, and then it will automatically scan your fingerprint and then collect payment from your default card. And again, this is with your iPhone 6 or 6 Plus. Just tap the top of the phone to the little reader. It scans in about a second or less, and then it accepts the payment and just simply says, done. It's gone smoothly for me the first few times I've used it. I have noticed that in subsequent times that I've tried to use it, I'll hold my finger down, I'll tap it to the terminal, it'll scan my fingerprint, and then I get a little message that says, hold it near the, you know, hold your iPhone near the terminal, and then it takes a few seconds before it actually registers the transaction. But other than that, it worked really, really well. If you don't want Apple Pay to use your default card when you tap the terminal, if you tap it without resting your finger on the Touch ID sensor, it'll give you an extra step where you can actually select the card that you want to use and then prompt you to actually scan your fingerprint to complete the transaction. But I am loving Apple Pay, and I'm really thinking that this is going to take off in a huge, huge way. I think a lot of retailers are going to want to jump on board and support it for just the security features, the convenience features. It does feel to me a lot faster than pulling out your credit card and swiping, even if you don't have to sign it. So I am loving Apple Pay at this point. But unfortunately, not everyone is, and we're starting to see a battle shape up over Apple Pay already. Now, Apple has said they have support from over 220,000 stores. They have support from many of the major U.S. banks, also all three major credit card issuers, Amex, Visa, and MasterCard. In the first 72 hours of going live, Apple says they had over 1 million credit cards activated on the Apple Pay system. So, you know, right out of the gate, it's feeling like a huge success. But despite all of that, they are getting pushback from some pretty big name retail locations. And it's seeming like the real challenger is something called the Merchant Customer Exchange, or MCX. And it's actually a group of these sort of major retailers that have gotten together, banded together, and they're building out their own payment platform called CurrentC. And it's an app-based platform. So it relies on you downloading an app to your iOS device or your Android device. And what has been happening is Apple Pay was working on a number of terminals at retailers, because these NFC terminals have been out in the marketplace and deployed for a long time. It's just a lot of retailers hadn't been using them. There wasn't a mechanism to use them. Not everybody had credit cards with the NFC chips in them. Well, now Apple Pay comes out, and a lot of those terminals just worked right out of the gate, because it's seeming like as long as the terminal supports NFC, then it supports the Apple Pay technology. But a lot of those retailers turned out to be members of this Merchant Customer Exchange, and they quickly started turning off the NFC support on their terminals. So even though the NFC was there, and even though it could take an Apple Pay payment, they were turning it off. And Rite Aid was one of the first companies we heard about in the US, and then they were quickly followed by CVS. And then I don't know if Walmart ever had it activated, but Walmart's come out and said, we're not going to be accepting Apple Pay. And it turns out that these are all members of the Merchant Customer Exchange. And apparently in the agreement for being in the MCX, there's an exclusivity clause. So it says you cannot take any other form of payment. Now, there's not a penalty fee associated if a merchant in the MCX wants to take Apple Pay, like was being reported. You may have seen a report that said, oh, they're charging a fee. That's not the case. They do have this exclusivity clause. So if you're going to take any other form of payment, you can no longer be a participant in the merchant customer exchange. So, splitting hairs a little bit, but they're not fining their customers. And that turns out to be a good thing, because actually we've already had one dissenter of the MCX, one of the first MCX members to sort of break ranks and say, you know what, we are going to take Apple Pay, is the grocery store chain Major. And it's unclear at this point if they're going to be allowed to continue as being members of the MCX. MCX, or the currency app and technology, hasn't been rolled out widely or publicly. I think they've got some beta testers, some initial testing going on right now. So I don't know what happens when they have their full rollout, if they'll sort of, you know, throw down the gauntlet to Major and say, look, you got to choose either Apple Pay or currency. But that's sort of how this battle seems to be shaping out. And, you know, really, when you start digging into the currency technology, I'm having a hard time understanding, you know, why anybody would actually want to use this technology over Apple Pay, because it doesn't seem simpler. It doesn't seem more secure. It doesn't seem more private. But, you know, I'll let you be the judge. So here's how the technology works. So if you want to use currency, and this is just my understanding based on what I've read, I haven't actually used the technology, so it might be a little bit different than I'm describing. But everything that I read sort of says what you do is you have to first download and install an app. So that's already sort of one barrier. And then when you're at a merchant and you want to actually make a payment, you have to open up the app. You have to scan a QR code that's at the point of sale. And I guess this sort of registers and sort of says, okay, I'm at this retailer. And then when you scan that QR code, it generates another QR code as a payment token that's shown on the screen of your iPhone. It verifies your presence, your identity, and then starts the transaction between the bank and the retailer. And then what you have to do is you have to display that QR code, or give your phone, show the QR code to the merchant, and then the merchant scans that code, and that code acts as the payment token. So it sounds like, in terms of security, it's a little bit like Apple Pay in terms of it's using a tokenized payment, so it's not passing actual credit card or bank data back and forth. But that's really where any sort of similarity ends between currency and Apple Pay, that they're both tokenized. And the tokens are likely very, very different. And currency seems much more complex, much more cumbersome, and definitely offers a lot less privacy. And I think this is likely to be the biggest thing that's going to lead to its failure with consumers. Not the technology itself, not what's going on under the hood, but just the fact that it's cumbersome, it's burdensome. They don't use contactless NFC technology. You actually have to have a physical thing. You have to launch an app. Another barrier is it doesn't work with the credit card system. And this is by design. Currency is designed only to work with prepaid store cards or debit cards that are tied directly to your bank account. So what it does store is your bank account information, or at least a direct connection to your bank account. I should say I'm not 100% sure it's actually storing bank account information, but it is going to have a direct connection. And being based on debit cards, a big deterrent is that passes any sort of fraud liability onto the consumer, not the merchant, not the bank. But just like your debit card, if you have your debit card lost or stolen, those things aren't covered by, say, like your credit card's fraudulent charge system. So they're definitely going to have to address that issue at some point. And I haven't read or heard anything about how they're doing that. And currency, it looks, is like really designed to allow retailers to avoid credit card charges. They hate the credit card companies. They hate having to take credit cards and pay the 3% in credit card fees. And this is sort of the lob, the technology that they're banding together to sort of push forth to try and get past that. They've been trying to get past those fees and find other forms of payment for years, which is one reason why they really like the prepaid store cards. I think that plus, you know, something I don't like about prepaid cards is that you're basically loaning your money to the retailer. Until you come back and use that card, they have your money and they're able to use it, and you're not getting interest. You're not earning, you know, that money's not earning anything for you. It's just sitting in your wallet, not doing anything. So I don't find gift cards or prepaid cards to be a really good solution. And currency also doesn't do a lot of the things that Apple Pay does to protect your privacy. Actually, it's designed not to protect your privacy. They want to be able to track you. They want to know what store you're in, what your purchase history is. And they're saying this is all to make you better offers and give you loyalty rewards programs so you don't have to carry around those loyalty cards. Well, they like those loyalty cards, again, because that's a way they can track you. They can keep track of purchases and stuff like that. Now, they have said that customers within the app will have the ability to turn off location-based services. They can opt out of the marketing communications and things like that. But even if you do that, it's unclear whether or not they're going to be passing that tracking data back and forth. And, you know, at the end of all of this, some of the retailers behind the currency technology, in my opinion, really don't have the best security reputation. These are a lot of the same companies that over the past year we saw get hacked and had their systems hacked. As a matter of fact, Currency on Thursday notified a bunch of their beta testers that, guess what? They had been hacked. Unauthorized third parties had obtained email addresses. It looks like it's also email addresses of folks who potentially signed up just to be notified of when the currency technology and system was available. And, you know, you've got retailers in there like Target, who had arguably one of the biggest security breaches in recent history and stolen customer information and data. And Currency is storing all of that data and information in the cloud. Walmart is a partner. They made the statement that they believe merchants are in the best position to create a mobile payment service for consumers. I would argue, in my opinion, I think they're probably about the worst people. I would think you'd want your financial information with banks, with credit card companies. People have worked in the industry, know about securing and protecting data, those sorts of things. Now, Currency claims that they are subject to U.S. health insurance portability and accountability standards, basically the HIPAA Act for data security requirements. It requires any internet-facing data to actually be encrypted. But Electronista noted that those emails that were stolen were actually stored in plain text. So obviously they weren't complying with that. So I don't know what's going on with this company. The technology is all software-based, no NFC, no fingerprint scanning, no secure enclave for securing your, storing your data, no secure chip. And again, it has this exclusivity clause, which is causing retailers to disable Apple Pay on their NFC terminals, giving consumers less choice. So this is not about creating choice, I think it's just not good all the way around. Now, the good news is that there now seems to be a very large and vocal revolt coming against Currency, and it's not even out or widely available yet. So it may be a non-starter. It may be killed before it even gets out of the gate. To me, it's feeling very similar to the whole ultraviolet digital copy sort of battle that went on between iTunes and Ultraviolet, which was developed by, the film and movie folks. And I think, you know, another thing that's interesting about this fight is that disabling NFC not only affects Apple Pay and us as Apple fans and iOS consumers, but it also affects Android consumers, because without NFC, Google Wallet doesn't work. So iOS folks and Android folks finally have a common enemy. They're kind of coming together to fight MCX. And Tim Cook commented recently that the fight is just a skirmish. And he noted that, you know, merchants will only be relevant if they are loved by their consumers. If, you know, they offer you the things that you want in terms of how you want to pay, how you want to be marketed to or not marketed to, how you want to be tracked or not tracked, those sorts of things. So there's sort of started up this call to boycott a number of the companies that are in MCX. As a matter of fact, there's a website called Boycott MCX that's maintaining a list of both NFC Apple Pay merchants as well as retailers that are MCX partners. So you can easily go to the website and you can check out and you can see which retailers are the ones you want to go to support, who are supporting Apple Pay, and the ones who maybe you want to avoid. And I have to say, I know I want to do the boycott, but there are some big folks in the MCX camp. You've got people like 7-Eleven, like Circle K, CVS Pharmacies, Exxon Mobil, The Gap, Kohl's, Lowe's, Michael's, Old Navy, Sam's Club, Shell, Target, Walmart. I'm looking at this list going, I don't know where I'm going to shop if I want to participate in the boycott, but I'm certainly going to try. You know, I prefer Lowe's generally over Home Depot, but I'm going to start going to Home Depot because guess what? They're supporting Apple Pay and NFC. What's interesting, the most interesting thing about this fight to me is Target, who's not going to support Apple Pay at the terminals in their retail stores, but they are supporting Apple Pay within their app. So I guess for Target, I've got to buy online in the app and then just pick up in the store. It's just a very weird battle and it's shaping out to be a pretty ugly one. And there's a lot of people on both sides saying, you know, already declaring that they're going to be the winner. But at the end of the day, I think consumer convenience, privacy, and security is going to win out. And if you look at those measures of which system will be successful, Apple Pay wins it, and it's no contest. It's actually a blowout because the MCX currency technology can't seem to offer any of that to consumers. So what do you think? I mean, what do you think about this battle? And this isn't just coming from being an Apple fanboy sort of thing. This is just looking at the technology and going, this is just a bad idea, in my opinion. I'm not going to install that app. I'm not going to support, you know, I'd rather just pull out my trusty old credit card and scan it at the terminal. At least they're not disabling that in those stores. But I'm really hoping Apple Pay wins and becomes much more ubiquitous, or other technologies like Apple Pay. I haven't dug really deep into Google Wallet. I don't know how it compares to Apple Pay. I like the fact that Apple Pay relies on my Touch ID scanner and has some additional security features. So, but that's not to say Apple Pay is perfect either. They've had some minor technical bumps of their own. Right out of the gate, some B of A customers reported that their credit cards on Apple Pay were getting double charged. B of A did turn around and issue refunds on any duplicate charges. But if you have a B of A credit card and have been using Apple Pay, you might want to double check your statement, make sure that you got your refunds or any credits. I actually saw something similar to this with my Amex card when I scanned it. It didn't take a transaction. Both transactions showed up in my transaction history, but actually only one was charged. So I don't know if, you know, that's a similar thing to what was going on with B of A, but I did only get one charge, which was a good thing. And then another little hiccup with Apple Pay is some users reported that the credit card images that were appearing in Passbook after they scanned their cards didn't match the actual cards, or they were getting generic logos. But these are really kind of minor little hiccups and bumps, and there's going to be some growing pains as Apple builds out and deploys Apple Pay. But they're already reportedly looking to expand the Apple Pay technology and features, which is great. There was a report saying that they're actively scouting out partnerships for things like building security, so being able to use your Apple Pay or your, I guess you wouldn't call it Apple Pay at that point, but you know, basically the NFC in your iPhone to get into buildings and get security access. They're all also looking at it for public transit tickets and other sorts of things. I would imagine tickets for sporting events and theater and all those sorts of things would be great applications for the Apple Pay NFC technology that's in our iOS devices or in our iPhone 6 and 6 Pluses. So I'm really looking forward to what Apple does with the Apple Pay NFC technology. I think there's going to be big things ahead. And, you know, I think when this battle all shakes out, Apple is going to be at least one of the lead players in sort of this new way of making mobile payments and paying with our devices. We talked earlier about the latest Mac updates, but also at the last event, there were significant updates to the iPad Air. The iPad Air 2 was announced, and it's now in the wild, and it's being inspected and run through its paces, and it looks like quite a nice upgrade, especially from the inside out. iFixit tore it down. They took a look at that A8X chip, and here's something interesting. It appears to be a three-core design, which is a little bit unusual. We've seen some Android tablets already running four-core processors, so we had dual-core. Now this one supposedly is a triple-core. Apple Insider noted that the three-core design actually smokes Samsung's own Octa application processor, which they claim has four active cores or eight advertised cores, and it's the processor that's used in the new Galaxy Tab S 10.5. And in benchmarking, the iPad Air 2 came in 69.5% faster in multi-core tasks and 104% faster in single-core tasks versus that new Samsung processor in the Galaxy Tab. And it was able to do that with just 2 gigs of RAM versus the 3 gigabytes of RAM in the Galaxy Tab. And it was discovered that the iPad Air does appear to have 2 gigs of RAM, and I think that makes it the first iOS device to actually break the 1 gigabyte of RAM barrier. So to date, all iPads and iPhones have come with either 1 gigabyte or 512 megabytes of RAM. iPad Air 2 seems to have doubled that finally. And as far as what the chip is running at, it seems to be clocked about 100 megahertz higher than the previous iPad Air processor, so coming in at 1.5 gigahertz versus the 1.4 gigahertz. And it does all of this with a smaller battery, actually 15% smaller, 7,340 milliamp hour battery, but it still maintains the same battery life specs as the prior generation iPad Air. So Apple, you know, doing some things I would think with energy efficiency able to eke the same amount of battery with a little bit less under the hood. And it likely has a little bit less in there because it did get thinner, and maybe they need a little bit of extra space. But beyond that, there were also some external and internal design changes. I think we talked about the removal of the orientation lock and mute button being the biggest external change that, you know, apart from the new thinner profile. But then internally, there are also redesigned speakers, repositioned Wi-Fi antennas. They're now located at the top edge on the Wi-Fi model, and you've got dual ambient light sensors as well as the dual microphones in there. And then along with, you know, sort of the external change of the orientation, mute button being removed, control center on the iPad Air 2 looks a little bit different if you go in there. It now has separate mute and rotation lock buttons. You're not going to see those on an iPad Air because you've still got the physical switch. But if you have an iPad Air 2, you're going to have a little bit different UI in your control center. As far as how performance goes, overall, the iPad Air 2 scores roughly 13% higher on single-core benchmarks and 55% higher on multi-core benchmarks versus the prior generation iPad. And it appears to be smoking the competition, in even though, again, it's running less cores, it's running less RAM, and those sorts of things. So that kind of makes you question, you know, why is the iPad Air 2 so much faster, even though the raw specs seem to indicate that it might be otherwise? And I think, you know, it's the classic rule that numbers don't always tell the whole story. It's not all about specs. It's not about what you have. It's actually how you use it. So Apple actually opts for faster RAM, not just more RAM. They're using fewer cores, but they're opting to use 64-bit versus 32-bit architectures. And they're doing all this while, you know, preserving energy, and maintaining battery life. And they are able to tightly integrate the hardware and software so that they can squeeze every milliounce of performance from their devices. And that's something that none of their competitors use. It means that their devices run faster, they work harder, and can do more with seemingly less under the hood. And that's to the benefit of us in terms of user performance, user experience, And, you know, that is really something the iPad and no other company can really touch. And Apple talks about this quite frequently when the subject comes up, when they're doing their quarterly results calls, when the Q&A and things like that. So you can't always just rely on bottom line specs. And I think most consumers, it doesn't even matter to them. They are going for what's my best user experience, what has the apps that I want to run, what can do the tasks that I need it to do. And that's why so many of them continue to choose the iPad over some of the other things that are out on the market that, you know, frankly, have what looks like on paper, better specs, lower price points. But they just, at the end of the day, I think they don't match the user experience or performance that you get with an iPad. Now, another interesting thing that was found during the teardown is that both the iPad Air 2 and the iPad Mini have an NXP NFC controller. This is the same controller, NFC controller, that Apple uses for Apple Pay in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. But Apple has said that Apple Pay on the new iPads only works with the in-app version of Apple Pay. You can't walk into a retail store, tap the terminal, the NFC terminal, with your iPad Air or iPad Mini 3 and actually make a payment. So it was kind of a little unclear why the chip is actually in there. And so there's been some speculation that maybe it's in there so that the iPad could actually act as a point of sale or payment terminal that would actually accept Apple Pay from an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus or an Apple Watch in the future. And that to me makes sense because we've seen iPads that are used as payment terminals. It could also mean that maybe at some point Apple might just turn on Apple Pay support for iPads, or at least it seemed like that might be the case. But several people then immediately pointed out that, well, the new iPads, they don't have an NFC antenna. So that leaves the speculation that maybe the chips are there simply to house the secure element, which is where Apple Pay payment data is stored. And that would be for use in the in-app payment feature. So on your iPad, when you put in your credit card information and data, that, you know, gets turned into that unique ID, which is then stored in that secure element chip. And maybe that is part of that little NFC chip that's in there. And that's where everything is going. And to me, that seems the most logical explanation, especially if you don't have the NFC antennas in there. It's going to make it really hard to use the NFC technology for any other purpose. But just something interesting to note in the new iPads. And that was only discovered when the teardown happened. So did you get a new iPad Air 2? I'm actually still on the fence. I have an iPad Air. I absolutely love it. But I'm seeing these performance benchmarks and the new thinner iPad Air. It's really, really tempting. And when I look at what I can get for my iPad Air 3 on Gazelle, it brings the price to a point where it ends up being pretty appealing. So I'm a little on the fence. I've actually already got my offer. I have my box to send in my iPad Air to get my credit. And I've had that iPad Air 2 in the shopping cart on the Apple online store more than once. I'm thinking I'm very likely going to pull the trigger. But if you got a new iPad Air 2 or even a new iPad Mini 3, I'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on it. Shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last thing in the news I want to talk about this week, and it's a pretty big one, it's that whole GT Advanced thing. GT Advanced, if you don't remember, that's the company Apple was partnering with to do sapphire glass production. They actually did a deal where they loaned the company some money to buy some new furnaces. They were going to create all kinds of jobs in Arizona. The state even gave some tax credits and things like that. Well, everything kind of blew up when the iPhone 6 came out. A lot of us, including myself, thought we were going to see sapphire glass displays. That didn't happen. And you immediately started wondering, well, what was all that GT Advanced stuff about? It turns out that GT Advanced was unable to kind of meet Apple's demands and needs. Those demands seemed very extreme. Now that the details are coming out, and I don't frankly know why they would have agreed to some of the terms. But because of that, It's looking like they're not going to be able to create that business. They are filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and the whole thing's a really, really big mess. Now, I don't run a business podcast, so this story is pretty big news. It doesn't interest me a lot, but because it's such a big deal, I thought we should talk about it a little bit. What's really intriguing is how big a failure this seems to be. And, you know, it also shows why we might not get Sapphire screens on our iPhones or iPads anytime soon, if ever. You know, it had been talked about in the media that, you know, this was an ambitious project. Nobody, I think, really knew how ambitious it was. Or I guess some people actually did. Maybe it was just me who didn't want to believe them. I thought, you know, I had faith in GT Advanced. I think Apple did as well, that they could overcome some of these production issues. But they had to step up really, really big. The gist of the story, as far as I can tell, is that GT Advanced made some pretty large commitments to Apple, and they were unable to you know, sort of come through on those. And that's a big oversimplification. Like I said, I'm not a business guy, so I'll just give you some of the details that I know and understand, and you can kind of maybe help me decipher it. But the details that came out seem to indicate, even to this non-business guy, that this is one of the worst deals in history. I don't know why GTA would do this, but they took huge risks and agreed to an exclusive deal with Apple for the Sapphire glass. There was no guarantee, though, that Apple ever had to buy any of this glass from them. And if Apple didn't, they weren't in a position to be able to sell it to anybody else. So I don't know what they were going to do with this glass. The original plan was for Apple to buy 2,600 Sapphire furnaces for the company and other equipment that GTA would then operate. But later that was changed to Apple loaning them the money for the equipment. And I guess they were going to pay that back from the profits they were going to make from Apple. And it seems all, again, not, to a non-business guy, seems a little bit convoluted, but I guess it was kind of an advance, and then they were going to pay it back. They agreed to produce, I guess when they do Sapphire glass production, the sort of thing that gets generated is, and I'm probably mutilating this name, but a boule, B-O-U-L-E-S. So they agreed to produce 262 kilogram boules of Sapphire glass within a certain time frame. And that was even though the company's furnaces currently could only produce 115 kilogram boules. So they had to basically more than double the size of that production, and they needed to do it within a very tight deadline. And I guess they were unable to meet that deadline. And while all that was going on, the price of Sapphire ended up being significantly lower than they had expected. And Apple had a future deal that in 2015, the prices they were going to pay for that Sapphire glass were going to go down even further. So it made it even a less lucrative deal for GTA, who couldn't even meet the production, I guess, requirements for 2014. And so, you know, they had all that looming over them. And then again, they agreed to these really oppressive terms from Apple. They faced extreme fines under the exclusivity agreement if they broke it. So $640,000 if they sold any Sapphire to another company. $650,000 if they loaned out a furnace for production to anybody else, and $320,000 per boule if they delivered one late. And I guess each one of these Sapphire glass boules is only worth about $20,000, something like that. So, I mean, $650,000 penalty if they sell one to somebody else and only make $20,000 for it, it seems outrageous. I don't know why anybody would agree to this. If somebody is a business lawyer or somebody and can explain this to me, I guess they really had faith that they could do the production and they could get it done. But, you know, with all that, Apple had the right to cancel a purchase order without paying GTA anything. And, you know, as a result of all this falling out, the two companies have quote unquote agreed to part ways. GT Advance is filing for bankruptcy. Apple has released GT from all exclusivity obligations, so now they are going to be able to sell their furnaces to someone else, and I guess that's how they're going to make the money back to actually repay Apple the $439 million prepayment advance that was made. They're going to have 4 years to do that, and Apple's going to do it without charging them any interest. And then GT is going to retain ownership of all production and inventory assets at the Arizona factory. Really, the worst part of this whole thing is probably the impact to the state of Arizona and to the workers at the GT Advanced factory. I think I read in one report they had hired up to 1,300 workers that would include sort of full-time staff as well as part-time and I think seasonal workers, folks to help kind of get the factory up and running. But about 727 workers got notice they're going to be losing their jobs at the plant in Mesa, Arizona. An Apple spokeswoman said that the company is focused on working with the city of Arizona and the county to actually help those employees try and find new jobs, is I think what they're going to be doing for them. But the whole thing is just a big mess and fiasco. And, you know, as much as Apple, you know, Apple made a killer deal here. I mean, they obviously had the upper hand in this contract. And you may argue, well, you know, that's just, you know, some folks, I think, look at this and think that's Apple being really oppressive and sort of throwing its weight around. But these guys didn't have to agree to it either. I don't think they were forced into the agreement. It doesn't seem that way. I think they earnestly thought that they could actually do the deal. And had they been able to pull it off, they would have made a lot of money, and this story would have gone completely the other way, I think. It would have been a huge, huge success. Unfortunately, it turned out to be a massive failure, and a lot of people are going to sort of get hurt in the fallout. The only one kind of not getting hurt in this, I think, is Apple, other than the fact that they're not going to have sapphire glass in their iPhones. But they've obviously found another material in the ion-infused glass and are going to be moving on. And they'll get sapphire production, you know, somewhere else for the current places where they use it, the Touch ID sensors and the lenses for the cameras. And that's not to say there won't be a sapphire iPhone screen in the future, but it's looking like it's not going to happen anytime soon at this point. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to get into some of the feedback we've been receiving. Specifically, one of the big things I'm getting asked about a lot, and I think we talked about this a little bit on the last show, is one of the new features that's in OS X Yosemite. So OS X Yosemite is out. I know a number of you are running it. And one of the features that I was most excited about, and I think a lot of us were most excited about, is the continuity handoff feature. And unfortunately, it turns out this relies on having a pretty modern Mac to actually be able to work. You need to have Bluetooth 4.0 and LTE support in your Mac. And that means like models like my 2011 MacBook Pro, 15-inch MacBook Pro, are out. I don't have this specific kind of chip that needs to be in there. Well, it turns out that there is a way to hack continuity support onto older Macs. But after digging into it, after looking into it, and you may have read about something called the continuity activation tool, this is something that turns out to be not for the faint of heart. It requires several things to happen and could potentially damage and harm your Mac. But I thought I'd share it with you because there is a way to do it. It requires a very specific wireless card to be in your Mac, and you can actually open up an older Mac and install one of these if you can get your hands on one. And it seems to be pretty easy to actually source the part. So if you get a very specific card with Bluetooth 4.0 LTE support, this can be done for 2011 MacBook Pros and quite a few other Macs. You need to have airport card BCM94331 PCIe BT4CAX. That very specific model, and it has the BT20702 chip. If you have that in there and can get it installed in your Mac, then you can use this software, this continuity activation tool, to actually fire up and sort of hack and modify OS X Yosemite to recognize your older Mac as one that is supported. So you can get that airport card in there. iFixit has instructions for tearing open your Mac and getting the card installed if you need that. And then using the activation tool, you can enable support in Yosemite. But I will warn you, after reading through and looking at the activation tool, to me, this is very risky as far as I can tell, and I will not be trying it on my Mac system because it really doesn't seem worth it. Because what the tool does is it disables some OS security features in order to work, and then you run the risk of ending up with a non-bootable Mac on the first restart. It even warns you of this, and it also says that you could end up with a non-bootable Mac if you do something like a PRAM reset. So it just seems to me like a lot of things can go south here, and all just to get continuity on an older Mac. I don't really think that's worth it. The one thing that I'm still investigating, and if you find any information about it, you know, I'd really love to hear about this, but is what I mentioned on the last show. If any of those little Bluetooth dongles that you can connect in with USB can be supported out of the box without hacking. After reading about the continuity activation tool, though, I'm thinking this probably isn't possible, because it seems like at a very low level, you kind of have to disable some of the security sandboxing controls that are built into the operating system to actually enable other Bluetooth devices that aren't pre-installed by Apple or, you know, aren't part of the system already to actually get it to work. I'm still kind of digging in. Again, if you have additional information and things like that, we'll keep looking into it. But as far as I know at this point, Continuity Activation Tool is getting a lot of press. I've heard from some of you who have done it and said it works great. You've had no issues. As a matter of fact, some of the Macs that are supported, all you need to do is run the activation tool, and you actually already have the chips in your Mac to actually make it work. That just proves to be more puzzling to me, because why wouldn't Apple allow those systems to work out of the box? There has to be a good reason for it. And again, that would be another reason for me not to actually run the software to do this. But I wanted to make you aware of it because it has been around and up in the news, and several of you pointed me to the continuity activation tool. But it's a little bit more involved than just sort of running a little bit of software and getting the continuity support. We've also had a few of you write in to say that you're having issues with iTunes 12, and not just the UI issues. There's a lot of folks who are not happy with, you know, the icon changes, a lot of the UI changes in iTunes 12, the loss of the sidebar. Although I will let you know, and I can't remember if I mentioned this on the last show, there is sort of a way to quasi get the sidebar back. If you go into iTunes, into the main window, and you're in your music library, if you click on playlists, the playlist still has the sidebar, and you can still get to all of the sections within a category. And that's sort of the caveat, is once the sidebar comes back and you're in the music section, it's only the music portions of the sidebar. If you're in the movies category, then it's only the movies portion of the sidebar. Whereas in the past, when you had the sidebar, you could jump between the sections. In iTunes 12, you still have to use the little tabs in the upper left-hand corner to do it. But a number of folks wrote in to tell me that they're having troubles now with music syncing after upgrading to iTunes 12. And this is syncing music over a direct USB connection, which a lot of us like to do. It's actually my preferred way to actually sync music when I was doing it. I've since moved on to using iTunes Music Match, so I don't sync my music anymore. But if you are and you found that your music is no longer syncing once you've upgraded to iTunes 12, Andrew may have found a solution for you to kind of jog things back into play. And I actually saw a similar fix in Apple's discussion threads. And I think what this hinges on is just sort of toggling the music library that it gets created. And actually, when you do sync your stuff, your music from your Mac and iTunes to your iOS device, there's actually a little library file that gets created. And I think going through a process to actually wipe that out and reset it is what can get things back up and running again. So in Andrew's case, what he found was that if he just ended up checking the manually manage music box in the music settings on the device in iTunes, then it would pop up. It generally gives a warning saying that music and videos are no longer going to be synced to the phone. So you're basically turning off the direct syncing. And when you do that, it will then sync the entire library, which seems counterintuitive, but I guess that happened in Andrew's case. I always thought when you were manually managing music, what you had to do was actually drag the music over that you wanted to sync. But regardless, you check that manually managed music box and it will kind of go through the process of syncing everything back up, or just running the sync process, I think is what happened. And then after that, all you have to do is then uncheck that box. And when you do that, it's going to warn you that music and videos on the device are going to be replaced with the content from iTunes, which is actually what you want. So I think the first check actually sort of wipes everything out on the device, resets that music library file, or actually removes it, and then checking it back on will start your syncing back up again. You're going to have to wait a while all of your music is synced back onto your device, but then it should be fixed up and it should be working fine, and future syncs should continue to work. And as a matter of fact, this fix can actually work for a number of media syncing issues. It's kind of a fix that we've used in the past when album art would get out, you know, funky and mismatched. If you ever remember doing that, one of the best ways to do it was to sort of remove all of the tracks from your device, get all of the content off the device, and then resync everything back on. And I think it kind of forces a rebuild of that music library on the device and gets everything back up and running again. So if you've upgraded to iTunes 12, you've been having trouble with your music syncing, you might give that a shot. If that doesn't work for you, or if you have a run into this and found another solution, be sure to let us know about it. And we'll try and also mention that on a future episode of the MacCast. Now that OS X Yosemite is out, one thing that Apple did and has done in the past when a new operating system comes out is they seem to pull the older version of the operating system, in this case OS X Mavericks, from the App Store. And several folks noticed that since the release of OS X Yosemite, OS X Mavericks is no longer available on the Mac App Store. If you had previously downloaded OS X Mavericks, or and this would be on any of your Macs, it should still be available to you if you go into the purchases area of the Mac App Store. But if you never downloaded it, you never upgraded to it, you're not going to be able to do that now, at least not directly from the Mac App Store. You're actually totally out of luck. And I confirmed this with Apple support. I put in a support ticket, said, you know, what happens if I don't want to upgrade to Yosemite? I just want to get a copy of OS X Mavericks. How can I do that? And they basically said, it's no longer available. You're advised to upgrade to OS X Yosemite. And you might be wondering, well, what if my machine doesn't run Yosemite? Well, OS X Yosemite is actually supported on all Macs that were supported by OS X Mavericks, which may be the reason Apple is taking a little bit of a harder line with this upgrade than they have in past upgrades. Now, what they did tell me was that if you absolutely only want OS X Mavericks, you could try contacting AppleCare support and they might be able to help you. And they were very clear about saying might. They said, you know, availability can change from day to day in terms of OS X Mavericks, even on their end. And that in essence, this is handled on a case-by-case basis. And it will just be based on what day you call in and whether or not they have availability to give you OS X Mavericks. So if you didn't make that USB stick that we talked about when we talked about upgrading to Mavericks, you may be out of luck if you never upgraded. So maybe find one from a friend, see if somebody made a copy of that thing. I don't know. And, you know, I think technically, and I probably should point this out, technically, if you get a copy from someone else, that may be considered piracy. I guess it would be considered piracy, but I kind of don't see it that way. If Apple's not making it available, the software was actually free. I think we're kind of in a technical gray area here, aren't we? No, a lawyer probably would disagree with me, but seems that way to me. But I will tell you, since OS X Lion, since Apple kind of went to this, you know, digital distribution of the operating system and not having something I can walk into a retail store and buy a DVD of, I started creating a USB installer for each OS I installed. And it used to be kind of difficult back in the day. You kind of had to run some cryptic terminal commands or maybe do some things with Disk Utility. Well, now it's pretty easy because you have Disk Maker X, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Or you can just Google for the instructions if you really want to do it manually with terminal commands. But, you know, just get a copy of Disk Maker X And then all you need to do is, you know, download the installer. So if you didn't do this with Mavericks, I would really encourage you to do it with OS X Yosemite. So what you do is you download OS X Yosemite, but when it launches, don't run the installer. Quit out of it, and then the installer will just be downloaded and sitting on your Mac. You'll find it in the Applications folder, and it'll usually say something like OS X Yosemite install.app or something like that. I don't remember the specific name, but get it downloaded first. Don't install it. And then, of course, make sure that you have a backup of your Mac, and then run DiskMaker X. Just launch the application and then have a 8 gigabyte or larger USB flash drive available and just follow the steps. It'll walk you through the process of actually creating the USB disk, and your USB stick will get erased during the creation process, so don't have any other data on there. Have a clean stick, but once you're done, then you will have a USB stick with a bootable version of the operating system and installer on it, and just, you know, throw that in a drawer, and then you will always have it to use whenever you want to install it on a new Mac. So I just wanted to mention that. You know, I think it's unfortunate that Apple pulled Mavericks, because I'm sure there's some folks out there, there's some scenario where you just don't want to run Yosemite, but you're really not going to have the option. Apple's saying Yosemite moving forward, and this is what we have available for you. On the last episode, or I think a few episodes back, when we talked about the release of iOS 8, one of the topics that came up, of course, was the new third-party keyboards. And we were having a discussion about those keyboards in iOS 8 and the fact that some of them require or actually need you to set the allow full access option so that it has, so that the third party app actually has full access to all of your key presses. And I was a bit concerned about that. I think a number of us were a bit concerned about that. So I had dug in and kind of discovered that the reason developers need to do that is because of a few things. It would allow the third-party app to have a smaller footprint in terms of the keyboard itself, because it wouldn't have to have all of the app functionality sort of stuffed into the keyboard that's running, you know, inside the core of the operating system. It also allows the keyboard to share data like key presses with the host app, so it could use that information to, say, do things like suggestions, those sorts of things, you know, corrections. But it also means that that data could be allowed to be sent over the network. It could phone home. It could go back to the third-party keyboard application. So, you know, one area where you really might be concerned about that would be passwords. When you're entering passwords, say, into Safari or any app that might request a password. Well, Carlos emailed me after that discussion to point out something very interesting with third-party keyboards, and I had not noticed this, but what he pointed out was that anytime you get to a password field and you're using a third-party keyboard, the third-party keyboard is not allowed to be used, even if you have the allow full access option turned on. So that means that in iOS, at least for password fields in Safari, when I did my testing, what it'll do is it'll automatically switch back to the built-in keyboard. And I think I confirmed this with a couple of apps as well. When it popped up and wanted me to enter a password login for an app or on a website in Safari, it would flip over to the built-in keyboard. And then when I went to the next field, it would flip back to my third-party keyboard. So I thought that was a nice little security feature. I don't know if that existed in the initial release of 8.0, and maybe that's just why I missed it, or maybe it was there the whole time, and I just didn't catch on to it. But thanks, Carlos, for pointing that one out. I thought it was a pretty neat thing. As far as how OS X Yosemite upgrades are going for people, I've been hearing from a lot of folks that the upgrade process is one of the best that it's ever been for an OS X upgrade. Very few people seem to be having any issues. That was kind of my experience when I was running the OS X Yosemite beta. I'm still not upgrading my core operating system yet. I'm still waiting a little bit because there are a few issues. It's a little bit rough around the edges. And, you know, you kind of have to wait a little while to get all of the little obscure issues that might be happening. And I just heard about one of these this week from listener John, and this is what he had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is John from Las Vegas, Nevada. Love the Mac cast. Keep up the great work. So I had a little problem in upgrading to Yosemite, and I wanted to share what I'd found in case it helps out some other users out there. I had a preference pane that I had installed on my Macintosh for many years, and it had been working just great. When I upgraded to Yosemite, for some reason, the preference pane software wasn't starting when the Mac had rebooted. I could go in to System Preferences, into the preference pane, and start it, and then it would work just fine. But for some reason, it just wasn't starting automatically when the Mac started up. So I did some research, and I discovered that Apple changed how programs start up in OS X Yosemite. So in my case, I had an older preference pane. In this case, it was the TiVo desktop software, which is a couple years old. And it still works great, but it's not being kept up to date. So Apple changed the way that programs are starting. It used to be that there was a folder called Library Startup Items, and there was a process that developers could use to have their program start automatically. And Apple got rid of that whole process, and I was able to find a way to fix it and use the new process. So I'm sending along with this voice comment a couple of hyperlinks that really helped me out. So it requires a little bit of terminal commands, a little bit of working with some plist files, but it's easy to do. It only takes a few minutes, and I was able to get my preference pane working and solve my problem. So I'm passing that along, and I hope it helps out some other users. Thanks so much, and have a great day.
Hey, thanks, John. I appreciate the links, and I will have those in the show notes at maccast.com in case you've run into issues similar to John and want to sort of hack around and see if you can't fix this yourself. I would advise checking with whatever developer. It sounds like in your case, John, you know, this was an app that's not being updated or maintained anymore by TiVo, but hopefully the developer has upgraded and has a new version of their app that's going to work with Yosemite, because this is actually something that is a change, as you noted, to the startup items. It's a deprecated technology. They had been warning developers about this for a while and saying, you need to move to our new system, which uses a startup daemon. And just to be clear for those folks who are maybe wondering, what we are talking about here is something called startup items. These are a little bit lower level sort of thing than just the login items, those sort of apps that start up when you start up your Mac and are defined to launch in the System Preferences. If you go to System Preferences, User Groups, and to the Login Items tab, this isn't what we're talking about. This is something more like SQL processes or other startup items that are lower level processes that get started up in the background. And these can be installed by various applications. And there was a process for doing that. That process was deprecated. And as John pointed out in that message there, it no longer works because Apple used to have it set up so that any items that were in the library startup items folder in your home folder or the system library startup items, those would get launched by Apple's own system starter launch daemon. So the system daemon would actually go through and see those things in there. And they were typically just these plist XML files with definitions saying, okay, go here and start this application, things like that. Those used to get automatically started by the built-in system launch daemon. They also removed the SBIN system starter file. So all that whole process was removed. And what Apple replaced it with was something called launch agents. And these are per user session agents or launch daemons. And these are the ones that are used for sort of system-wide scripts and applications. So they now have these two new things. And so the way the fix that John was talking about works is you basically need to go in and rewrite and move the old startup items plists and put them now in their own plist files inside a folder called Library Launch Daemons. So a Launch Daemons folder inside the Library folder. And not only that, you need to then also add them to the Launch D daemon using a terminal command Launch Control. So there's a terminal command you need to plug in to actually, you know, get the system to recognize those things. Like I said, hopefully your developer has upgraded their application and is using the new process and has built all this in for you. But if you have some older software, you may have to hack this in yourself. And that's where those links that John passed along are going to be very helpful. And again, those will be in the show notes at maccast.com, kind of explaining everything and including a link to Apple's developer documentation all about the startup items and the change and things like that if you want to read up more on it. All of this is great, and thanks, John, for sending that information along. I'm sure it's going to help some folks out, but I wanted to bring it up mainly because it really serves as a good reminder to all of us that with any new operating system, there can be unexpected behavior. There can be stuff that you installed, you know, three versions ago that has been running fine and then suddenly pops up in this new version because, hey, guess what? Something got deprecated or no longer works anymore, and now is suddenly a problem. I think, actually, Ted Landau over at Mac World ran into this problem. He was running an old copy, had not upgraded his version of Audio Hijack Pro, and it had something, one of these lower level things that was running that caused all kinds of havoc on one of his systems when he upgraded to OS X Yosemite. The fix was easy enough. It was just upgrading Audio Hijack Pro, but sort of troubleshooting and figuring out what went wrong and where this thing was, that was a little bit of a chore. So, you know, if you are planning on upgrading, do some of your due diligence, do some of your research in advance, and especially backup. Just in case you need to roll back, you need to jump back quickly, you're going to want to have that backup. But, you know, really take that inventory. Don't forget the small stuff, things like startup items, menu items. Look at your system preference panes. What's in there that you maybe forgot about? Drivers for scanners, printers, any kind of peripherals that you might have attached. Look at plugins in applications. A big culprit can be mail plugins. If you've been using plugins in Mail, plugins in Safari, look for those sorts of things. QuickTime plugins. Any old hacks or workarounds you might have installed. For me, one of the big things I often worry about is I do a lot of homebrew stuff. I, you know, compile and build things in the command line in the terminal, and that's all stuff that doesn't come pre-installed as part of the operating system. So does that stuff need to be upgraded? Is it, you know, out of date, or is something that I'm going to do in my upgrade going to break that? So any of those kind of low-level installs. So just take that inventory before you upgrade, and make sure you check developer sites for any notes on OS X Yosemite compatibility. Are you going to need to upgrade? Do you need to buy a new version? Oftentimes, you know, you might find, now I've got to rebuy this program that I really didn't want to rebuy. You know, I have to upgrade to the latest version of Office because the old version of Office isn't going to work anymore. So check in on all that stuff and just make sure you're going into your upgrade eyes wide open. So thanks for pointing that out, John. And then I also just wanted to comment real quickly on a couple other bugs people have noticed since upgrading to OS X Yosemite. Like I said, it's been a relatively smooth upgrade for most people, but there are a few things. One of the more serious ones is I've seen some reports of Wi-Fi and Bluetooth connectivity issues. These do seem to be isolated, although it's hard to tell, you know, what segment they're isolated to. But what seems to be happening on some systems is that the Wi-Fi connection will just simply drop either immediately or within 10 minutes. And unfortunately, the only reliable fix for getting that connectivity back is to kind of reboot the Mac or reestablish that connection. Somebody did write a little script that you can run in the background that's going to constantly check to see if you have a Wi-Fi connection failure. And then what it does automatically is toggle the Wi-Fi off and then back on again, forcing the reconnection. I'm calling this the Roy Treneman fix for you IT crowd fans out there. So turn it off and back on again on your Wi-Fi if you're running into this issue. It should get you back connected again. But unfortunately, if it keeps dropping almost immediately, you're going to be doing this over and over again. So you may want to find the little script online and have that automated in the background. But probably not how you want to be running your Mac with the Wi-Fi constantly being flipped off and flipped back on just to maintain a connection. So there's that issue out there. The other one that's kind of serious is there is a little bit of an obscure, apparently, memory leak inside Mail. Some users are reporting that Mail.app can use up to 24 gigabytes of RAM. Basically, it just goes through and starts using up all of the available RAM on your system and then basically locking up Mail and you have to quit mail to kind of recover anything. And what seems to be happening, and actually you can't quit mail from the standard mail menu because the whole thing's locked up. So what you actually have to do is open up Activity Monitor from the Utilities folder and actually force quit the mail application. But in some of the support threads, it looks like what Apple reps are suggesting is that this issue may be caused by a third-party extension. Again, one of those mail plugins. They're saying, you know, look through and disable any extensions or add-ons that you might have in mail, and that could plug up this memory leak. I thought I had also read that it looked like one of the triggers might be attaching large number of files in the Mail Compose window via drag and drop. So you know, select a bunch of attachments and drag them into your Compose window. I'm not sure what the number is or the size, but there seems to be some indication that that may be a trigger. So that may be coupled with some third-party extension sort of triggering this thing. It does seem to be isolated, but I wanted to mention it just in case you ran into this issue, and that way you have some information to work with. But again, overall, Yosemite seems to be a pretty smooth upgrade. That's what I'm hearing from most folks. So I think I will be upgrading sometime soon. It's really now at this point just a matter of finding the time. Got some projects going right now, and I don't want to interrupt those. But the minute I have a little bit of downtime over a weekend, I'm probably going to be upgrading to Yosemite, because what I'm hearing is mostly positive stuff. And one of those positive things comes in the form of new features. And there's a really cool new feature that I discovered thanks to a great article by Melissa Holt over at the Mac Observer about a cool new feature in OS X Yosemite that I didn't even know was there. You know, it's a small feature, but it's one of those I think that's been a long time coming and is very useful to a lot of folks. And that feature is batch renaming. It's actually one of the features that Windows users constantly, you know, sort of hold over Mac OS X users' heads, that you don't have any kind of built-in functionality for batch renaming. Well, now we do, and it actually looks like it's pretty easy to use and actually pretty slick. So in the Finder, all you have to do is select the files you want to rename. So you can do a whole shift select thing if you want to select a series of files, or do the whole command select thing if you want to just select a few files that you want to batch rename, and then either right-click or control-click on the selected items. And from the contextual menu, you should see a rename X, you know, however many number of items you have selected. So if you selected 5 items, it's going to say rename 5 items. And when you select that, you'll get the rename dialog. And in that dialog, you have three options. You can replace text, you can add text, or you can format. If you choose to replace text, that's going to allow you to search and replace a piece of text within the file names selected. Add text will let you put additional text before or after your file name. And format lets you append the date or number sequence to your file names. So in the lower left corner of the window, it will actually display a little example of how your renamed file is going to look before you actually apply the changes. So select the change that you want to apply. And I think if you wanted to do multiple, so say you wanted to replace some text, add a suffix, and then add a number, you probably are going to have to do it in 3 steps. So replace the text in all your file names, then add, then format. They kind of don't all go together. So like I said, kind of a simplified renaming, but that's how Apple likes to keep things. Once you've got your settings all set up, you just click the rename button and your files will be automatically renamed. If you need more functionality, you know, then there's still those third-party tools out there that you can rely on. Things like a better Finder rename or Name Mangler. Really, the OS X built-in one is for sort of simple batch renaming. And Apple does this very often. And I like it when they do features like this, because they give us the basic functionality that we need built into the operating system, but still leave room for those third-party developers out there to kind of give us more advanced options and things like that. But just wanted to point that one out. And thanks to Melissa for writing up that article, because I don't think I would have discovered this one on my own. Kind of jumping back to mail a little bit, let's talk about managing mail attachments. This came up this week. I got a couple questions about this, and it always comes up in the realm of, hey, I'm trying to clean up my Mac, and there's all this stuff in mail, specifically the attachments. In OS X Mavericks, and I also assume Yosemite, attachments in mail can eat up quite a bit of space, and sort of finding and managing those attachments ends up being a little bit tricky. And the reason why is how mail typically handles attachments when they come in and where they're stored locally on your Mac. I started digging into this because Chris emailed me to say that he was able to save 13 gigabytes of space on his Mac by simply unchecking the automatically download attachments option in Mail Preferences accounts. You choose your account and that you want to manage, and you go to the Advanced tab for any IMAP accounts, and you'll see that little checkbox, automatically download attachments. And I tried this, and simply unchecking the box for me didn't immediately free up any space on my Mac. Now, I emailed Chris back to ask about this, and he said it did take a little while for the space to get freed up, so maybe I just didn't wait long enough. But what I wanted to know after trying this and after getting the mail from Chris was, you know, how is OS X Mavericks handling email attachments, and what exactly does the automatically download attachments setting do? So I dug in a little bit, and the automatically download attachments setting, according to Apple, changes what types of attachments are automatically downloaded to your Mac. So I guess by default, media attachments, things like images, PDF files, videos, and audio files, those are always automatically downloaded. So they, anytime you get an email with that type of attachment in it, it is downloaded and saved onto your Mac. If you check on the automatically download attachments option, if that setting is turned on, then all attachment types will be automatically downloaded and stored on your Mac. So this includes things like Word documents, spreadsheet files, zip files, anything that comes in as an attachment will be automatically saved. If you don't have that, only media attachments are saved locally. As far as where these things end up, prior to OS X Mavericks, they were in the Home Library Mail Downloads folder. So they weren't too hard to locate. And I'm pretty sure we've covered that on past MacCasts, is you can go in there periodically and kind of clean that folder out. What happened in OS X Mavericks is Apple made those attachments a lot harder to find. And if they're being automatically downloaded and you've been doing it for, you know, years, that could be eating up a lot of space like it was in Chris's case. So they're now stored in your home folder, in the library folder, in containers, in a folder called com.apple.mail, in a folder called data, in another folder called library, and then mail downloads. So no problem, you can find those, right? Again, that path, home, library, containers, com.apple.mail, data, library, mail downloads. Not only that, when you go look at the mail downloads folder, it's not like it was, you know, with the old mail downloads folder where it was just sort of there's the attachments. Now inside that folder, they are cryptic folder names with these sort of hashed IDs. And then within each one of those folders, you can kind of find the actual attachment that was downloaded. So like I said, items are automatically downloaded to this folder if you have the automatically download attachments setting turned on. But really, any media files you receive are also going to end up there. Not only that, but that's not the only way things can end up in that folder. Even if you don't have that setting turned on, so you follow Chris's advice and you uncheck it, there are certain actions that you can take that can cause the attachments to actually get saved into that folder. One is to open the file with a double click or open the attachment with a command in a contextual menu. If you control click on the file for any reason and just use the contextual menu command, if you control click but change your mind and just let the menu close, guess what? Too late. A copy is already stored the moment that you open up that menu. If you use quick look, a copy of the attachment is stored. If you leave the message window and come back and do any of these actions again, guess what? An additional copy of the attachment is created. So it doesn't seem like Apple's being very efficient about how it's storing these attachments. And if you save the attachment via the File, Save Attachments menu, or if you use the drop-down on the little gray divider line at the top of the message, not the contextual menu, then for some reason a copy is not saved in the Mail Downloads folder. So if you want to avoid having a copy automatically saved, make sure you go to the File, Save Attachments menu, or you use that little gray divider menu and use the drop down in there to actually save your attachments. Then you won't end up with these extra copies in the mail downloads folder. Even more frustrating or confusing is that editing an attachment from mail directly may or may not alter the downloaded copy. And what happens is it seems to depend on whether or not the app used to open the attachment is an Apple app or a third-party app. So if you double-click a mail attachment, it's saved into the mail downloads folder, and then it's opened up. If you alter it and save it, so not a save as, but just save it, it will then save itself back to the mail downloads folder, overwriting the copy. And then when you return to your mail message and you reopen the attachment, it's going to open up the altered copy, right? You're going to see the one that you edited. Not so, though, if you have an iWork document. So if you open up an iWork document attachment from within mail, again, it still has a copy saved. But then you go in and edit it. What you'll notice is the title bar will show the name untitled, and then the in parentheses, the original name of the file, copy. And then at that point, it's treated like a new document. So when you save it, it's actually going to pop up the dialog, prompt you to save it to a new location. It will leave the copy that it saved into mail downloads intact, right? Because it created a new copy of the file, and that's what got opened up in the iWork application. So just note that if you're altering your mail attachments just by, say, simply double-clicking on them and having them open up in the app. Again, also remember that's going to save a copy of it, eating up more of your storage space. So what about saving space? What if you don't want all those attachments in there, or you want to clear them out? You can go into that folder and actually delete items in that folder. Remember, if you're using an IMAP account, that stuff is going to be stored on the server unless you're doing something to specifically have attachments deleted from your IMAP server. So going into that folder and actually deleting items is not going to delete the items on the server. So you can go into the folder, delete them. If you ever need them back, go back to the original mail message, do any of the actions that we talked about earlier, and it's going to save a copy back down into the downloads folder. Now, of course, this is not going to work for POP accounts, since those messages are downloaded from the server and then removed, again, unless you've changed the POP settings in some way to leave copies on the server, which I know some people do. But, you know, out of the box, how POP works, you're not going to have those attachments are just going to be stored locally. So be careful if you're working with POP accounts. But with IMAP, where you're leaving everything on the server, you should be okay. And in my case, I went in and I checked, and I had about 400 gigabytes of data in my mail downloads folder. And I've actually periodically gone through this folder and deleted items. So if you want to save some space on your Mac, you probably want to go through that folder, take a look at things, and delete any of those downloaded attachments that you don't really need anymore. And you could end up with a scenario like Chris, where you save, you know, 13 gigabytes of data or space on your drive. And that is a significant saving. So thanks, Chris, for pointing that that sort of change out and reminding us that there's some space savings that can be reclaimed there. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by simply going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to thank CashFly for providing the bandwidth for the MacCast. You can find them at cashfly.com. That's CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. Want to give a big thanks to you for listening, for staying subscribed. Please tell your friends about the MacCast. We're always looking to expand the audience, expand the community, and get new subscribers. If you have any feedback for me, you have a comment, a question, you can, of course, shoot those to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything that I've talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a Google Plus community. You want to participate in that, just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. But with that, that'll do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.